I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to Diplopod. My guest today is Suzanne DiMaggio, one of the most fascinating people you may not know. She's been negotiating with Iranians and North Koreans for almost two decades. So, Suzanne, when you tell people who are not living and breathing national security issues, like many of us here are, what you do, I'm sure you silence a room or get a lot of funny looks at a dinner table. I want to start just with the basics. What are track two negotiations, as we shorthand them here in our world?
So track two is simply unofficial dialogue. Track one is easy to think about as the official talks, government to government. You see that happen every day. But track two are usually between non-governmental types and are more informal. So the point is to get to a place where you can be open, candid, and not have to just read from talking points.
And you can have track two negotiations with governments that the U.S. would not have track one negotiations with, as you have with the Iranians and the North Koreans.
That's exactly right, yes.
So there's a huge opportunity there. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, I just wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in doing this? Was it what you imagined you would do? Did you even know about it? Or how did it start?
I never even heard of it. I was working for an NGO in New York that was focused on the United Nations. And they were doing track twos mainly with Russia and China, with whom we have official relations. And at that time, I thought, wouldn't it be really interesting to do this track two approach with countries where the United States does not have official relations? So that was the seed of the idea way back when, and I set my sights particularly on North Korea, Iran, and Myanmar. The more difficult the case, in my mind, the better.
And it seems like you took on a couple of quite difficult cases. So I want to start with Iran. Most Americans, I would say 99.9% or higher, have never been there, don't know what it's like, what the people are like. What was it like the first time you went there?
Well, I've been there a number of times, I think five times, and it's really one of my favorite places to visit. I'd love to just go back as a tourist and not actually do work. So one of the things you find when you travel to Iran is how much the average person on the street wants to talk to you as an American. They're interested in it, and they actually like Americans. I think there's a natural affinity between Americans and Iranians. Of course, they may not like our government, and we do not like theirs, but I think the Iranian people themselves are sophisticated enough to separate the two. So what you often find is you'll be walking down a street in Tehran and meet people, and suddenly they invite you to their home for tea, and you actually say yes, and you go, and you have the time of your life. So it's actually a great place to visit. And one of the things that really troubles me right now is current Iran policy by this administration. Because anyone who's traveled through the region, including Iran, notices how much the Iranians actually like Americans. And I do think the current policy of these draconian sanctions being put back on is really damaging that sentiment. And it worries me. I think in some ways we're losing the hearts and minds of ordinary Iranians. And I think that could have a lasting impact.
Because people pay attention to it. And we may not think about that in the U.S. or in Europe, but they are tracking what's happening with these negotiations and how it impacts them.
Yes. And it's having a direct impact on their lives, their day-to-day lives, especially the middle class.
So one thing that most people, even who pay attention to negotiations, don't know is it's not like when you negotiate, you go to Iran or they come to the United States. Talk through, to whatever level of detail you're comfortable, how it works. You meet in third-party countries, right?
That's exactly right. So usually we meet in European countries. I think I've now been to Stockholm 42 times, maybe 43 times. So there are certain countries.
There are worse places to
spend
time.
There are worse places, especially in winter. Stockholm is lovely. So we do rely on the generosity of governments in other places, Europe in particular, to help us facilitate these discussions, because it's not always possible to go to Tehran and do this. In fact, it's not preferable, because we're not looking for that attention. So oftentimes we meet in European capitals, sometimes Asia, and other places too, but that's usually we're on the road.
And you've also are one of the few Americans who have been to North Korea. So tell us a little bit about what that's like, and what would people be interested to know about what it's like there?
Well, North Korea is quite different from Iran. There's virtually no similarity. It's very isolated. And also when you travel there, you're minded very heavily. It's not really possible to just walk around and see the sights.
Go to the home of somebody who invites you to tea, as you said with Iran.
Exactly. I would love to do that in North Korea, and hopefully someday we'll get there. But in the case of North Korea, I mean, one of my favorite things to do was to meet my interlocutors there. I like to see where they live. I don't go to their homes, but I like to see their offices, where they sit when they're doing their work. What's the view out of their window, mm-hmm. how the world looks from their vantage point. And I find having that experience and being able to see that with my own eyes very useful in thinking through how they see the world. And it really helps to put in context their approach to policymaking, how they see their own national interest. I find it so illuminating, and that's one of the best things about going there.
So give us some examples. When you've looked out their office windows, what has that told you about what their priorities are, how they would approach negotiations?
Well, when you look out the window of the foreign ministry, you see Kim Il-sung Square, which mm-hmm. is the big square where they have the big military parades. And when you travel throughout Pyongyang, there are pictures of the great leader, the dear leader, everywhere. So it is very much clear who's in charge, that this is ruled by a dynastic regime. And in that sense, it is fascinating to be there and experience that. So when I think about the differences between talking to Iranians and North Koreans, for example, when you sit down with five Iranians, it's very common to hear five points of view, or at least five different variations on a theme. But when you sit down with five North Koreans, you hear one view, and that's the view of the great marshal, Kim Jong-un. And there's very little, with Iranians, you can actually see them debating among themselves. With North Koreans, you really never see that. So that's an interesting difference.
Do you think that speaks to the level of control within the government, obviously? Does it speak to culture, or what do you attribute that to?
Probably a bit of all those things. So, of course, in the case, there are different governments, and I think many people look at the Iranian government and see a monolithic government, and it really isn't. They're, you know, very vastly different power centers, and they're all competing with each other. Whereas in North Korea, we don't see it that much. It's very opaque, so we actually don't know what's going behind the surface. But clearly, there is a supreme leader in both countries, but in North Korea, the supreme leader really is the main decision maker. Khamenei in Iran is the main decision maker, but he gets inputs from other parts of the government. So it's quite different.
So even though you've been leading these negotiations or a big part of them with primarily non-government actors and players, you do keep administrations abreast of what's happening. How does that work exactly?
Well, first, my interlocutors primarily are government officials, because in both countries, there's not a long tradition of non-governmental organizations. So by virtue of that fact, we're working with government officials. But on our side, on the U.S. side, I have the pleasure of working with a whole array of former senior U.S. officials, former diplomats, former military, experts on a wide range of fields. This is one of the best parts of this job, is the people you get to work with. And depending on what we're discussing, I'll bring experts on that particular topic. And then we have a core group that comes. And, you know, some of them have been doing this with me for nearly 20 years, which is incredible. So that is a key difference, is that I think in other track twos, you're usually meeting with other non-governmental officials. But in the case of Iran and North Korea, there's no flexibility to do that. It's very rare to have access even to non-government officials in this context.
And you want to be meeting with people who are decision makers, presumably, as well. So that's...
Yes. So that's one benefit, is you're actually sitting down with policymakers. For sure, that is, you know that what you're hearing has some level of authorization, and then you know what you're telling them is probably reported back to certain people in power.
And on our end, on the U.S. government end, you also keep people abreast, and you have through the course of several administrations, given you've been doing this for 20 years. How have you seen that change, or how has that worked as negotiations are ongoing, say, with the North Koreans or the Iranians? What role has your work played in that?
Well, there's been a fair level of consistency. In the case of the Iran dialogue, we started during the Bush administration, have gone through the Obama administration, and now here we are at the Trump administration. So I think that level of sustained engagement is quite unique. And with the North Koreans, we've been in contact with them in earnest, I would say, since 2015. And obviously, there's some level of consistency there. I would say the key differences I've experienced along the way is when our governments are attempting engagement or actually in negotiations, then you have to take on a different role. For example, during the Iran nuclear talks, there were some certain issues we just didn't touch during that time because they were being discussed officially. So we really did focus on the region and issues related to that. Now with the Iranians, since the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA, there really is no official steady channel for communications. So an unofficial channel like this, I think we've been busier than ever during this period because of that. And now, in the case of North Korea, where we see a nascent engagement, and hopefully that will take root and grow, we're adjusting our role there as well.
So what do you see, before we go on to North Korea, which is so present in the news these days, on Iran, what do you see, or what is your judgment on whether we can keep it going? What are they likely to do since the United States pulled back from the nuclear agreement?
Well, I think for the immediate future, we could expect to see the Iranians stick with their commitments to the nuclear deal. They continue to fulfill their commitments. I think the IAEA now has confirmed for the 14th consecutive report that they are fulfilling their commitments. And even though they're not getting the economic benefits that they signed up for, because that's a big problem we can talk about, I think they're getting something that they didn't anticipate, and that is the political support of the world, where the U.S. now is completely almost isolated in its view and approach, whereas the Europeans, Russians, Chinese, Asia in general, and so forth are supporting Iran in this deal. And I think that has given them at least some way to continue with the deal and make the case to the people of Iran why it makes sense to stick with it. But looking ahead, I mean, if they have 2 years to endure this, I think they can do it. But if we think it's going to be 6 years with the economic strife that they're facing, I think that could be very difficult. One of the things we may see is they may start enriching uranium again. And then when that happens, I think the situation will change quite dramatically, especially if it goes beyond that what's required in the allowed in the deal, I should say. Then I think they'll lose a great deal of support. And I don't think they want to see that happen.
So right now, it sounds like you're saying the leadership recognizes the value of the global community being with them. But if you're individual families or people in Iran, there's only so long they're going to support that if the economic benefits don't come back, or
exactly,
they don't see them.
If you're a family of four and you don't have enough food on the table, then you probably don't care how the international community is viewing the Iran deal at that moment. So it's going to be a very tricky balancing act for the Iranian government to find ways to address the economic hardship, Also, I think, you know, the Europeans are trying. They're about to announce something called a special purpose vehicle, which will allow companies, European companies, to engage in legitimate trade with Iran and bypass the U.S. dollar. It's terrible for us because the primacy of the U.S. dollar is what gives us such great power. And we're just recklessly letting this happen.
So I want to go on to North Korea. You have some heady topics that you're an expert on. Next month, President Trump is expected to meet for a second summit with North Korean President Kim Jong-un. What is happening now behind the scenes to prepare for that? Do you think it's enough? Or what do you think could happen at the summit? That's about six questions in one, but take it wherever you want to take it.
Well, I think since the summit, we virtually have seen very little progress, which is disturbing considering the pageantry that we witnessed in Singapore. But I think over these past 2 weeks, we've been seeing some positive developments, an exchange of letters, but more importantly, a meeting in the Oval Office just recently with the senior North Korean negotiator. And that apparently went well. And I think we'll soon hear an announcement for a second summit, probably at the end of February, perhaps in Vietnam. But I think more importantly is we now have a special representative for North Korea, who has the opportunity to meet his interlocutor and counterpart. So the real test will be, can that a channel for negotiation gain traction and really make some headway on concrete accomplishments. I think if there's not much time between now and the end of February, so the work is cut out for them. But if they could come up with a couple of key deliverables for the second summit, if the U.S. manages to lower the expectation from complete denuclearization to maybe some progress on a couple of sites, then I think we could call it a qualified success. And I think the key here is really managing the expectations and keeping in mind that this has to be a phased approach. It's not going to happen overnight, and it certainly isn't going to be easy. And what we really need that's been missing is face-to-face, intensive meetings. And until we see that happening, I don't think it'll be a success, but we see the beginning of that, and I hope it grows.
And because you've been a part of North Korea and our efforts for so many years, it was stuck for a while. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of doing the summit, what did or didn't come out of it, not from you, I'm just saying in general. But it was stuck, to be fair, or that was the external view. Can you talk a little bit about leading up to the first summit, what your view was of that, if you thought that was the right step or should it have been approached differently? Or,
well, I think it was 3 weeks after the inauguration of President Trump, I found myself in Pyongyang talking about what could be possible next steps in a new administration and asking the North Koreans how they see it. And at that time, they brought up the idea of a summit, which took me a little bit by surprise so early in the new administration. And you know, when I thought about it, I actually thought this was a good idea, given the psychology of Kim Jong-un as the omnipotent leader of North Korea, and given the psychology of our own president, where he and he alone can fix things, as he says. So I think the leader-to-leader approach has been a good one, given the two personalities. But what has troubled me so much is the real lack of preparation prior to the first summit, and then the absence of a coherent strategy since the summit. And some may say, well, why go through with the second summit? But I think the fact is, during this period, there's been a dramatic lowering of tension. The North Koreans have refrained from nuclear tests, missile tests. The tone, the rhetoric has become friendlier. These are all good things and we should maintain them. But I think we're getting to the point where we do need some concrete outcomes. And I'm hoping that's what we'll see in the second summit. And, you know, without the face-to-face meetings to get there, it won't be a success. So that will really be.
And face-to-face meetings, you mean among the experts?
Among the actual negotiators.
And negotiators, right. Yes.
So just this past week, our senior representative to North Korea, Steve Biegun, met with his counterparts. And hopefully they're going to meet again next week and then the following week. I mean, when you think back on the negotiations that went into producing even the interim Iran agreement, and this is a country that never possessed a single nuclear weapon, how much face time went into that, where negotiators met for hours, for days, for weeks to hammer out an agreement like that. And I'm not even talking about the final agreement. We need that sort of intensive diplomacy. And in the case of North Korea, it's got to be that to the nth degree.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was at the State Department at the time, and what many people didn't see was there were dozens of nuclear experts from the State Department and across the U.S. government who basically moved to Europe for 2 years to negotiate at that stage because, as you said, these are complicated issues and there's a lot of diplomacy involved. So what – I mean, looking at the North Koreans, obviously Iran is so different, as you've talked about. What is your – how should the U.S. government – how do they approach it differently than how the Iran deal was approached, or the Iran negotiation was approached, I should say?
Well, first, the cases are so different. I mean, North Korea now has anywhere from 20 to 60 nuclear devices, has intercontinental ballistic missiles – to deliver those devices. So this is a far more advanced program than the Iranians had. As I said, the Iranians never weaponized their program. So in the case of North Korea, it's far more challenging because you not only have to negotiate what you agree to do on denuclearization, but then you have to put in place a verification process. And again, with the Iranians, that took so much work to verify and put that in place. With the North Koreans, I think it's going to be even more complex. And then add on to that, if we get to the stage of dismantling any part of their program, that is a whole nother set of issues that have to be dealt with. So I think if we look ahead to the summit, are they going to, even if they decide to move forward with what the North Koreans offered, a decommissioning of the Yongbyon facility, that will, even that one facility, will require then detailed negotiations on how to go about that. The North Koreans are not fond of the IAEA, and it remains to be seen whether they will allow the IAEA back into the country. So who will do these inspections? We'll also need some creative thinking maybe to get around questions like that. Could it be inspectors assigned from the permanent five members of the Security Council? There's going to be a need for a lot of creative thinking to overcome what I see are going to be multiple obstacles along the way. But that shouldn't stop us.
Because it's not just, as you all know better than anyone, but for our listeners, it's not just the North Koreans committing to something. It's us being able to know they're actually doing it, right? The global community.
Yes. And then add on that the multilateral diplomacy that has to go on to make this happen. And that's another area of concern I have with this administration. Are they managing those relationships well? Are we managing our relationship with our close ally, the South Koreans? Are we working in lockstep, as they say? I don't think so. So that worries me as well.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I hope we can talk with you again as this all proceeds. But thank you, Suzanne, for joining us in the Diplopod studio, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much, Jen.
Diplopod is a production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Subscribe to Diplopod on popular podcast platforms such as iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at carnegieendowment.org/diplopod. Tim Martin is our audio engineer. Lauren Duick is our executive producer. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.